So if you've heard of Jesus, you probably know about one of his famous teachings called the Golden Rule. Do to others what you would want them to do to you. And this, actually, is a restatement of something else that Jesus said, that the meaning of life is to love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Now, that's really beautiful, but what does he mean exactly by the word love? It's an unclear word in English, because you can love your mom and you can love pizza. And if the word love means the same thing in both of those cases, your mom's gonna feel real bad. So what did Jesus mean in his language? Well, first of all, this love your neighbor phrase is a quotation from the Hebrew scriptures, where the word for love is ahava. However, the language Jesus spoke and taught in from day to day, it was a cousin language of Hebrew, that is Aramaic, in which the word for love is rachma. But then, as Jesus' followers spread his teachings around the world, they translated them into Greek, using the word agape. But here's what's fascinating. The earliest followers of Jesus, who wrote the books of the New Testament in Greek, they didn't learn the meaning of agape by looking it up in ancient dictionaries. Rather, they looked to the teachings of Jesus and the story of his life to redefine their very concept of love. So one time, Jesus was asked about the most important command in the Jewish scriptures. And he first quoted from the ancient prayer in the Torah called the Shema, "Love the Lord your God with all of your heart." So love for God is the most important thing. But then Jesus quickly followed up by saying another command from the Torah was also the most important, to love your neighbor as yourself. So which is the most important, loving God or loving your neighbor? Jesus' answer is yes. To ask the question means you don't get his point. For Jesus, they are two sides of the same coin. Your love for God will be expressed by your love for people, and vice versa, they're inseparable. And so this makes it clear that for Jesus, agape love is not primarily a feeling for someone else that happens to you, like our phrase, I fell in love. For Jesus, love is action. It's a choice that you make to seek the well-being of people other than yourself. Jesus also went on to teach that genuine love for God and others means seeking people's well-being without expecting anything in return, especially from people who are in difficult situations, who can't repay you even if they wanted to. According to Jesus, this kind of generous love reflects the very heartbeat of God. And he took this even further. Jesus said that the ultimate standard of authentic love is how well you treat the person that you can't stand. Or in his words, you shall love your enemy and do good to them, expecting nothing in return. For Jesus, this kind of enemy-embracing love imitates the very character of God himself. Now, we wouldn't be talking about Jesus still today if he had only said things like love your enemy. This is how he actually lived. Jesus was constantly helping and serving the people around him in very practical and tangible ways. And he consistently moved towards poor and hurting people who couldn't benefit him in return. He showed love for the forgotten ones, the people who usually fall through the cracks. And when Jesus eventually marched into Jerusalem, he made himself an enemy of the leaders of his people by accusing them of hypocrisy and corruption. But then instead of attacking his enemies to overthrow them, he allowed them to kill him. Jesus died for the selfishness and corruption of his enemies because he loved them. After Easter morning, Jesus and then his followers claimed that it was the power of God's love for the world that was revealed in Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. As the Apostle Paul put it, God demonstrated his own agape for us in this: while we were still sinners, the Messiah died for us. Or in the words of the Apostle John, God's own agape was revealed when he sent his one and only Son into the world so that through him we could have life. And for John, then, this leads naturally to the conclusion, beloved ones, if that's how God has loved us, then we ought to show love for one another. So Christian faith involves trusting that at the center of the universe is a being overflowing with love for his world, which means that the purpose of human existence is to receive this love that has come to us in Jesus and then to give it back out to others, creating an ecosystem of others-focused, self-giving love. And that's the New Testament meaning of agape love.
If you have your Bibles with you, if you would open to Deuteronomy 7, the passage that we heard read just a little bit ago. I want to share with you one of as we get started, one of the defining events or moments in my early relationship with Jane. It's not the one that she thinks I'm going to share right now. But it happened within the first week or so of us dating. I was living in this tiny, disgusting apartment attached to an airplane hangar at the Enumclaw Airport. So if you can imagine the airport for a town of about 10,000 people, the runway was just a long stretch of dirt. And so Jane and I would go out for a lot of walks on this runway, kind of up and back. That is until we found mice in my apartment. And she discovered, if you don't know this about her, that mice, rats, these things are her greatest fear. So Jane never came back to my place after that. But that was later. At the beginning, Jane and I are out walking the runway. And we start to have this hard conversation about our pasts. Jane had been following Jesus since she was 4 years old. And she had worked hard to love Jesus and to honor him with her life. And our lives had been very different. And I was still a fairly new follower of Jesus. And in a moment of strange boldness, I just kind of laid it all out there. That this is who I have been. This is what I have done. And the way that the night ended, I wasn't sure what was going to happen next for us. Jane was pretty quiet. It was a lot for her to take in, but she'd take some time to process it, and we would talk some more in a couple days. And so then a couple days later, we're back at the airport, and we're walking the dirt runway again, and I'll never forget what Jane said to me that night in the midst of a longer conversation. She said, if God has forgiven you, how could I not? And it was one of the first times that I had so tangibly experienced God's love through another person. As much as I believed God loved me, I was experiencing that truth that I was not loved because of how good I was. God loved me because he chose to love me. And I was experiencing that love through this human being who refused to hold my sins against me. So 15 years ago, to some extent, I felt unlovable, but believed that good news, that God loved me. That before I was ever born, God chose me. He sent his son to suffer and die for my sins. 2,000 years before I ever showed up on the scene, God knew me and he chose to love me. And so, regardless of whether I felt lovable or not, I was loved by God. And God gave me the ability to open myself to his love, to receive it from him, from Jane, and from others. I am loved by God. But there's a new problem that comes from knowing that. I know God loves me. I've experienced it through the years. My life has been transformed. I don't do the things that I used to do. In fact, just the other day, I was going to send somebody a message on Facebook, Facebook Messenger. And as I was pulling up the message, I saw a message that was sent to me in 2008, so 11 years ago. And the end of the message from this other person was something like, "As you used to say, dot, dot, dot." And it was this super crude, vulgar way of saying bye. And I was mortified. There are plenty of things in my life that I'm not embarrassed about. But reading this, I probably should be embarrassed about more. But reading this, I felt totally embarrassed. But it was also this reminder of just how far God had brought me. But way more than just not doing things I used to do, my life is now being given away for others. I'm a pastor serving God. I volunteer in our community. I'm trying to make the world a better place. If I'm honest, I rarely feel unlovable anymore. But my greatest temptation, or at least a significant temptation, is to feel a bit too lovable, too deserving of God's love. It's tempting to believe that I'm now doing enough to deserve God's love, that God somehow owes me love because of the way that I've lived the last 18 years, that certainly those have made up for the previous 18. In this place, the danger is that I might completely take God's love for granted. That believing I deserve God's love, I never actually turn to him anymore to receive it. That assuming God's love is always available for me and is actively coming after me, the danger is that I might stop receiving it. Stop being thankful for it. Stop seeing my need for it. And I can't think of anything more dangerous for our lives than to get to the place where we cannot or do not receive God's love anymore. This is the danger that we find in our passage this morning. This is the very thing that God has been warning his people about since some of the earliest pages of Scripture. If you have your Bibles open, Deuteronomy chapter 7, and then follow along as I read, and I'm actually going to start in verse 6, a verse before what we listened to earlier. And we read this, "For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession out of all the peoples who are on the earth." Moses declares that the Israelites have an unbelievable worth to God. They are a people that God has set apart as special. They are a people God has chosen from among all people. They are God's treasured possession. How much worth do these people have to God? I mean, think of your most treasured possession and then multiply it by a bunch more than that. Like, what does this then do to a person or people when the creator of heaven and earth calls you his treasured possession? When he declares you to have supreme value and worth in his eyes. How do you respond? God knows our temptation because he immediately addresses it. In verse 7, Moses lays out God's decision for them. He says, he lets them know, it was not because you were more in number than any other people that the Lord set his love on you and chose you, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it is because the Lord loves you and is keeping the oath that he swore to your fathers that the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. It was not because you were more in number that the Lord set his love on you and chose you. In the chapters that will follow, Moses is going to actually repeat this same idea, but in different ways. He's going to keep warning the people, beware that you don't say in your heart, my power and my might and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth, the stuff that God has given me. And then again, he'll say, know therefore that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness. For you are a stubborn people. You hear? You were not strong enough. You were not mighty enough. You weren't good enough. You weren't righteous enough. You weren't big enough to cause God to look on you and decide to love you. That is what Moses keeps saying to the Israelites. God didn't bring you out of slavery in Egypt because you were especially lovable. And God isn't taking you into the promised land because you somehow deserve it. And this is incredible news for us. Because if God loved you because you were lovable, what happens when things change and maybe these days you're no longer quite so lovable? If God was going to bless you because you somehow deserved it, what happens if somewhere down the road you no longer deserve it? The Lord set his love on you and he chose you because the Lord loves you and is keeping his promise. And then in verse 9, the Lord your God keeps covenant and steadfast love. Something both interesting and super confusing is happening in this passage. The word love keeps showing up in our English translations, and almost every appearance of the word love that we've read so far is a different Hebrew word. That's confusing. And like we heard in the Bible Project video, we can't just open a dictionary to define these words, but we look to the story of what God has done, of what God has been doing, which starts to give us a sense of it. And so the Lord set his love, or he in Hebrew, hasak, on you and chose you. This word, hasak, refers to desire or want. So this first line essentially is saying the Lord set his desire on you. The Lord wanted you and chose you. Because the Lord loves, a different Hebrew word, ahava, you. So this word, ahava, has a range of meanings. In some places, it means a profound friendship. In others, it refers to the love of a family. And then still others, we find it referring to the passion of romantic love. And so you have the story of Abraham. Abraham was known as the friend of God. God ahavad, his friend Abraham. And then God describes Israel as his firstborn son. And God ahavad Israel as his son. But then Israel is also described in other places as God's bride. And so God ahavad Israel, the way that Jacob ahavad Rachel. And if you know that story, it immediately draws a sense of what that word might mean, a willingness to work for years and years, and then even double those years just to receive your love. Moses is saying to his people, the Lord wanted you and chose you. Because God experiences a profound sense of connection to you, a connection that can't be captured just by friendship or family or romance, but it's sort of all of them and probably more, right? Take the power of any of these, and God's experience is so much greater. And so the Lord wanted Israel. He chose Israel. And he loves Israel with the love of a friend and family and lover. But then there's verse 9, where we read, the Lord your God is God, the faithful God who keeps covenant and steadfast love. Hear this. Know this. The Lord your God. Know this. Know this. Experience this in a deep way. The Lord your God keeps covenant and steadfast love. And this word love is chesed. This love, this chesed, is the love that we offer in our marriage vows. This is the place where we see chesed declared most commonly. It is loyalty. It is faithfulness. So when I work with a couple that's preparing for marriage, I always tell them the same thing. You could go and talk to Stella, who's in the nursery. We just had this conversation just within the last couple months. I say this, don't get confused about what's happening during this ceremony. I know that both of you are going to speak vows to each other, but don't let that get in the way of what's happening. See, because since there are two of you speaking to each other, the temptation is going to exist to think that these vows that you speak are connected or conditioned on each other. Right? That is, that if this person doesn't hold up their side, then I'm good to let go of my side. But there are no sides in a wedding. There are only two distinct and completely unrelated promises being made. The bride stands before the groom and before the crowd and the minister and before God and promises to spend her entire life becoming the kind of person who will help this groom grow in his humanity and in his Christ-likeness. No matter what the groom does, she promises to be that kind of person for his sake for the rest of her life. And vice versa, the groom stands before the bride and before the crowd and before the minister and before God and promises to spend his entire life becoming the kind of person who will help her grow in her humanity and her Christ-likeness. No matter what the bride does, he promises to be that kind of person for her sake for the rest of his life. It's within that commitment that we begin to identify with the other person as friend, as family, and as lover. We love our spouse by enjoying deep friendship with them, by experiencing the closeness, the intimacy, and the priority of family with them, and by cultivating passion toward them. And as we pursue them in this way or in these ways, we declare, I want this person, not in a creepy possessive way, but our desire is for them, for their good, for our unity. And this is what actually makes it possible that after 15 years of marriage, after 30 years of marriage, after 45 years of marriage, when youthful beauty is long gone, when the years have changed your interests, when life in the world has hardened you a bit, when everything in your life is different and has changed, you can look at your partner and say, honestly, it's not because of how you look or what you like or how much you make or even whether you are still keeping your wedding vows. I want you today. I choose you today because I chose you on that day. And you have become my friend and my family and my lover. I hasak you because I ahava you as friend, as family, and as lover, because I promised during our wedding to chesed you. This is the way the loves are working in this passage. And this is what Moses is doing. He is grounding God's very identity in the chesed love, in this love, above all other descriptions of God. Moses is declaring God is love, which sounds familiar, right? We've been in 1 John recently. It's something that is a New Testament idea we find in Jesus, but is all the way through the First Testament as well. God is love. God is chesed. God is faithful to his promises and his commitments. And so when God commits to a group of people, God really commits. God is all in. But God didn't commit because of who these people were or what they did. God committed to them long before they were even around. God takes these human beings and he pursues them like friends. He cultivates a sense of family with them and he pursues them like a lover. I mean, read through the First Testament and you will see God in pursuit of his people in all of these ways. He identifies with them in each of these ways. And so he experiences then all of the pain that comes from all of these sorts of relationships when they're broken, right? He feels betrayed by his friend. He feels dishonored by his family. He feels rejected by his lover. In verse 10, Moses says it this way, while God is busy loving his people, choosing them, they are busy not choosing him. The biblical word for rejecting someone or choosing something over someone else is hate. And so God's friend hated God when they looked for friendship with the world. God's family hated God when they shamed him and refused to trust him. God's lover hated God when they rejected God in favor of other gods and other lovers. God offers himself to his people, but they cannot, they will not receive his love. They have taken his love for granted. They have assumed that they deserve it. After so many years of failure, by the time Jesus arrives, many have begun to believe themselves unlovable. There are so many reasons why we struggle to receive God's love, and all of them lead us to the same place. We betray, we dishonor, or we reject the one who loves us. We hate God. Which leaves us in an awkward place, according to our passage this morning. Moses tells us that God repays to their face those who hate him. Repayment comes in the uncomfortable form of destruction. God won't be slack with those who hate him. He will repay him to his face. Which brings us to Advent. This is the season, we're in week 4 of the season, of preparation for God's coming to us. As we look forward to Christmas, we ask the question, when God took on flesh and he met the people who hated him face to face, what happened? When God took on flesh and dwelt among us, when he came and he met with people face to face who hated him, what happened? Well, we're told that Jesus is the visible image of the invisible God, and everywhere that Jesus went, people were brought back to life. He restored them, he healed them. And we can go through the gospel stories again over and over. And the question we have to ask is, how was Jesus repaid for his love, for his faithfulness to his people? Well, he was the one who was destroyed. His very own people were not slack with him. They gave him what they thought he deserved. He suffered at their hands. The ultimate act of love and commitment, Jesus refused to fight against those who could no longer receive his love. Instead, he died in their place. He died at their hands. He showed them the lengths that a God who keeps covenant and chesed will go to love his people. And it was in this place, seeing what they had done to their own God, where the hearts of many were softened. I think of the sermon that Peter preaches on Pentecost when he tells his people, when he tells God's people that they have crucified their own God, the Messiah. Their hard hearts were softened, and they were once again able to receive God's love. We celebrate Christmas year after year because this was the moment when God refused to remain in heaven. God wanted his people, as Moses says. He chose them. And he needed them to see the height, the width, the depth, and the breadth of his love for them. He had never loved them because they were good enough, because they had earned it, because they deserved it. He loved them because he made them and he made a promise to them. And the rest is history. And so as we prepare to finish this morning, we're confronted with two realities. The first reality is nearly overwhelming. At least it needs to continue to be. And that first reality is this: the endless, unwavering, passionate love of God. That this is a given in reality. In fact, it is the most important given that exists. This is our starting place for everything. But the second reality is this: we must receive God's love. We must receive God's love. And this might feel like a duh sort of thing, but we can't just do it once, but it has to happen over and over. And there are so many things that in our lives keep us from remembering this and from continuing to open our lives to God's love. And there may be days where we feel more lovable than on other days. But again, our lovability has nothing to do with whether we are loved by God or not. And so regardless of whether I feel completely worthy or deserving of God's love, or whether I feel completely unworthy or undeserving today, we must receive God's love again in this day, this moment, and tomorrow, and the next day. And as I think back to what Jane's forgiveness did for me 15 years ago, I am becoming more and more convinced that God sends people into our lives, people who offer us love, tangible expressions of God's love, self-giving love. And these become opportunities to confirm just how open we are to love. I've shared this with a few people lately, but this summer during sabbatical, I came across maybe one of the best descriptions of the spiritual life that we have in Jesus that I've found, and I just continue to come back to it, and I find it compelling, and it just resonates with me deeply. But talking about our spiritual life, maybe you know this experience, it can be really difficult to talk about how my spiritual life is going. It can feel really ambiguous. Like, how do I talk about my spiritual growth? How do I know how my spirit is? But I love this definition that I came across this summer. Spiritual growth is expanding your capacity to receive love from God and others, and to offer that love to other people. Your spiritual life, your spiritual growth is based on your capacity to receive God's love and to receive love from others, and the extent to which you are then able to offer that love to others. And so, what is your capacity today to receive God's love fresh, to hear that you are loved, to trust that you are a beloved son or daughter of the Most High God? And what is your capacity today to receive love from others? I think that there's an interesting gap, if you will. We do Christian things, we show up to church, we read our Bibles, and so we sort of assume that, yeah, I'm letting God love me. But then there are these expressions of love around us that are coming towards us, that are being given to us, and we can't receive them. And just like the video suggested earlier, love for God and love for others are tied together. I think there's a case to be made that love from God and love from others are actually still tied together. That our ability to receive love from others, from humans, from people that we can touch and hug and know and be in conversation with, that our capacity to receive love from one another reveals the extent to which we can receive the love that God is offering us. So, do you know today how deeply loved you are? Are you able to receive and rest in this love today? If not, this morning is as good an opportunity as any to let God love you again. Today is the day to prepare to receive Christ's love anew.